This episode of Travel Today with Peter Greenberg is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial.
It's time for Peter Greenberg Worldwide with America's number one travel news journalist. And now, the man who travels over 400,000 miles each year, your travel detective, Peter Greenberg.
Hi, everybody. Peter Greenberg here, and welcome to the podcast that's done from a different location around the world every single week. One day Canada, the next day Thailand, then New York, London. You just never know. This week, we come to you from
the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, one of my favorite airports, one of my great all-weather airports, and we'll be doing the show throughout from this airport. A lot of interesting people to talk about and to talk with.
My next guest knows a little bit about this airport because he happens to be the executive director and chief executive officer of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Brian Ricks, how are you?
I'm great, Peter. Welcome back. It's
great to have you back. You know, here. I love coming here, and it's not just because of the Mall of America. Although I have been known to do a flyby to go shopping.
That's great. That's great.
But you know why? Because they ship.
They do.
They do.
Yeah. They make it easy.
They make it easy.
Although we'd like you to keep coming back, flying through our airport.
I know. Well, that brings up the point. I grew up in New York City, but when I went to college, I was going to Madison, Wisconsin, so a neighbor state. I was coming through here all the time on airlines like North Central, Northwest, Ozark, if you remember that, out of St. Louis.
Braniff.
Now you're dating yourself. yes, Braniff came here. Yeah. I mean, when you think about the history and the legacy of this airport, right? Because when I first here, this was an airport run by Northwest, right?
Well, yeah, yes. 80%, yeah. They had 80% of the activity, yeah. and they certainly wanted to weigh in on what was going on here. So, yeah. Tremendous influence.
But it was an airport for most Americans that if they flew to, they were just connecting. Most of the time, they were flying over. But if you're coming here, it always struck me as an airport that actually worked.
Yeah, works very well. I mean, especially in this climate, we have a tremendously efficient operation. We're Delta's, as you know, second largest hub. Delta's very pleased with the operation. It's with our business climate in the Twin Cities, with over 17 Fortune 500 companies. They are very pleased with that business travel and pleased with how we operate this airport. Most efficient, I think, most profitable hub of theirs in the country.
Really? Well, let me ask you this, because I spent many days in Madison, Wisconsin with the layered look because of the weather.
Right.
One of your challenges here, and there's another airport that's like yours, and they do a great job as well, which is Salt Lake. I mean, you ask the guys at Salt Lake Airport, how many times a year do you close the airport because of weather, because of snow? And yet people are always going there to ski, right? It's very small.
It is. And we, you know, our groups, our crews are dedicated. We have over 100 pieces of snow removal equipment that are out working on the airfield. We just had 8 or 10 inches of snow last Wednesday and Thursday. And so that challenges us, but they do a fantastic job. And unlike waiting, you know, on highway road crews can wait and move snow after there's 4 or 6 inches.
You don't wait.
It has to be gone. You can only have about an inch and a half, 2 inches of snow, and it has to be moved. But our crews do a fantastic job. They can open up one of our 10,000-foot runways in 5 or 10 minutes. That's how quick they are.
That's fast.
It is.
That's fast. Now, operationally, you've improved in terms of the number of flights.
We have. We have about over 1,100 daily flights, currently 400,000 daily.
You know, most people who are traveling, they're only focused on their flight. Right. They don't realize you're over 1,000 flights a day.
We are. So it's a very, very busy airport very small airfield. We only have about 3,500 acres here.
And no room to expand.
And no room to expand. We added a north-south runway back in 2005, and that helped.
And that was a big deal.
It was a big deal. I mean, I think that runway, when I originally started my career here back in the mid-'80s.
Doing what?
I was involved in noise. I was involved in the noise abatement department, and so...
So you were Mr. Decibel.
Well, I know a lot about noise, I'll say that. But anyhow, they were when I left here in 1990 to go out to Denver and get involved in the Denver Airport Project, which had just broken ground, they were talking about...
By the way, in those days, DIA stood for doesn't include airplanes.
Right. Well, yeah, I was at that airport
Mayor
for a
Wellington
year.
Webb,
yep.
And I was out there, the airport that just couldn't open for a while.
Yeah.
And you had the baggage system that used to eat bags. You remember that one.
I do remember that.
That was a visual.
And I was not involved in that project.
Yeah. And then the runway started to sink at one point, right? Yeah. Great. Now, that's a great airport.
It's a fantastic airport.
It is.
Fifth busiest in the country, I believe it is.
Exactly.
So you got
down and dirty there before you came back here.
I did. It was a great learning experience. First major hub airport to be developed since Dallas-Fort Worth back in 1978.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, that airport opened up what year?
That airport opened up, so I was there from 90 to 96. It opened up in 1995.
Right, and the reason why I'm bringing that up, it's the last new major airport opened in the United States in 23 years.
That's right, and it took us about that long here in Minneapolis to build that north-south runway, which has been a tremendous improvement to
right.
our capacity.
But now you can't get any bigger.
We can't. We're limited. I mean, we obviously have freeways on all sides. We've got the river on the east side as well. So we do a very good job of maximizing capacity at this airfield. Actually, in 2005, we were up to about 1,500 takeoffs and landings a day. And the trend since then has been larger aircraft.
Right.
And less,
in those
less
days,
operations.
You had a lot of DC-9s and a lot of 7-3s.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the prop aircraft. I mean, you remember the 19-seat Jetstream aircraft,
right.
The Saab 340s, which were,
oh, they were
34
terrible.
Passenger aircraft.
Oh, my God.
So those have been all
and the ATRs.
Out. Yeah, and the ATRs. So it's all regional jet, and larger. And
plus,
so
you've improved your international routes. You're going nonstop from Minnesota to where?
To a number of European communities, to Iceland, to and we've recently added
Tokyo.
Additional flights to Haneda, yes.
Yeah.
And
by the way, Haneda is a great airport now.
It's a fantastic
airport. Everybody thought Narita was the answer. Everybody now wants to get the hell out of Narita and go to Haneda.
Right. A week ago, yeah. I started new service to Seoul. Delta has put in a request for Shanghai as well out of here. I mean, the only Asian destination we really had or connecting up or destination was Haneda. Now we've opened up Seoul.
And you mentioned Haneda. When Northwest was here, they depended on Narita. Because that was Project Fugu.
Right.
And that's how they were able to hub in that area. Every flight, it was an amazing scheduling thing, right? Every flight they had going to Tokyo from every different Northwest destination got in at the same time and had an hour and a half to turn everything.
Right.
And then go back out to Asia.
Absolutely.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And so Seoul is kind of that, is part of that now. 80 different connecting opportunities.
And by the
in
way,
Seoul.
I'm sure you've been out there. That airport
beautiful.
In Incheon.
Beautiful.
Unbelievable. Yeah. That is state of the art.
It really is. Terminal 2 is fantastic.
Yeah.
You probably noticed when you step off the airplane, it's just quiet.
Yes.
It's different from the U.S.
airports. It's a little scary.
Airports.
It's scary yeah. quiet. It's like, yeah. did they evacuate the airport and
right.
not tell me? No, this is just the way it is.
Yeah. So that's a fantastic destination for us. Mexico City is coming online in June. Aer Lingus is going to be starting
to Ireland from here?
To Ireland, to Dublin
well,
from
well, the
here.
Good news is, for people listening, you don't have to live in Minnesota to be able to fly out of it. I look at it as a secret hub. For most people that
yeah.
don't get it, right?
Right? Yeah.
And anytime I'm trying to do a transcon flight between New York and L.A. or New York and San Francisco, and either the fares are terrible or the availability is terrible, I'll look at Minnesota and go, I'll make a stop, and it works.
Absolutely. Works well.
Yeah.
You can always rely on it. It's a great connecting hub.
So what's your biggest challenge?
Well, I think for us, from a industry perspective, I think it's continued funding. I mean, you look at forecasts out there, and they're saying that globally there's going to be 8.2 billion passengers flying. That's doubling from what it is now by 2037. And so it's really about keeping up with the infrastructure demands.
Right.
We're in a $1.6 billion infrastructure program right now that consists of a number of projects. New hotel opened in July.
I saw that, yep.
We're doing a new 5,000 space parking structure, and we have an operational improvements program that really is a complete remodeling of and expansion of ticketing, baggage, and vertical circulation.
MSP, the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. We're speaking with Brian Ricks, the executive director and big poobah here on all runways at all times. Airport revenue. My philosophy, now don't get mad at me, but My philosophy is, you know, when I get up in the morning, I don't want to just go to the airport. I want to get through the airport. Mm-hmm. My mindset was that I didn't wake up in the morning to go shop at the airport, eat at the airport, dine at the airport, dance at the airport. The actual reality of the world we live in is I will be spending time at the airport.
Right.
It's inevitable.
Right.
Right? So the models have changed. Mm-hmm. Right. 25, 30 years ago, airports made money on landing fees and some concession or rents. Yeah. But that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And parking. Right.
Right. Right.
Today, it's retail and everybody wants Wi-Fi. And about 10 years ago, the biggest pet peeve I had was that every airport signed their own different contracts. And if you didn't want to spend money for Wi-Fi, you couldn't get it.
Right.
Right. I mean, and people were just tearing their hair out. Now you have, thank God, free Wi-Fi.
We call it complimentary Wi-Fi because we still pay for it, but the customer does not. So we like that.
Thank you. I'm going to call it, I'm sorry, I'm calling it free Wi-Fi. But you know what? It makes a difference.
It does. It does from a
customer. And you finally had to realize that, right? Because it was a negative touch point for your travelers.
It really was. I remember when I was interviewing for the job here and my wife came over with me. And we sat down as we were leaving, and she said, "You got to go through three or four steps to get onto the Wi-Fi. What's going on?"
Or pay for it.
Yeah. And so we streamlined it. We made it complimentary and
free.
Our passenger scores, satisfaction scores have just increased substantially since then.
And passenger levels of tension have gone down.
Absolutely.
Look, people don't change their lifestyle when they change their location. They want their Wi-Fi.
They want their Wi-Fi. We want passengers to be happy because a happy passenger will spend more money. In the terminal facility.
Well, you just segue to my next subject, and that is retail. You changed that around.
We have. It's, as you were saying, I mean, airports used to be considered just a utility where you'd come to the airport, you'd get through your ticketing process, you'd buy a bad cup of coffee and get on the plane and get out of there as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
With 9/11 and all the security changes, people are dwelling more in the terminal facilities, and we really look at it more as a hospitality. We're a hospitality industry because we want to provide the amenities that individuals want when they're coming through here. And it's new concessions, it's local flavor, that when passengers, whether origination or destination traffic, or if it's connecting passengers, that they get a sense of what Minnesota and the Twin Cities region is all about when they come through our facility.
And the thing is, you upgraded the food. You did.
We have, substantially. Brought in local venues that
have done a
fantastic.
I mean, there used to be two oxymorons in my business, right? Airline food and airport food.
Right.
Oxymorons.
Oxymorons.
Airline food is still probably in that category. But airport food has completely changed.
It's completely changed. We've got great venues here now that are just fantastic.
Your favorite place to eat?
I think it's Stone Arch. They do a great job. They're just right below where
we're talking. What kind of
food are we
talking about?
It's a variety of, it can be pub food, it can be a great piece of salmon. And then we're bringing in a really high class a facility or restaurant, which will be a very classy dining experience. And that will be here, I think, by the end of this year.
Cool. So more time at the airport.
More time at the airport. Spend time. People tell me that they wish they could be stranded longer here in Minneapolis.
Oh,
The local community says that so they can spend more time visiting our shops and our concessions.
Okay, now look at me straight. Do you believe that?
I do, because they get stuck in other airports that they just really don't enjoy.
So you're winning by omission.
We are.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Or by default. You're winning by default.
But we're winning. We are winning because we've been voted number one airport in the country between 25 and 40 million passengers for the last 3 years in a row.
And let's talk about your passenger count, because that's going nowhere but up.
It is. We've set record numbers the last 2 years, just over 38 million, so over 100,000 passengers come through here on a daily basis.
But again, it's one thing to boast about passenger numbers, but then you have to deliver, which is why you and I both like getting off the airport in Seoul going, wow, this is cool.
Absolutely.
Because you're not standing in a line.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, we are doing things, we're doing a lot of work around big data, trying to collect as much information, data that we possibly can to streamline that passenger experience, to get people through the ticketing and TSA screening, and really observe where people are dwelling, so that we can, again, provide the amenities in those areas that they want.
And yet you're dealing with the terminal space you were given, right? You can't mess with that too much.
What's interesting about Minneapolis-St. Paul is this building was built back in the early 60s. But unlike building a whole new airport and spending millions and billions of dollars, we've been able to transform this facility and really keep up with what the passenger demands are.
Of course, you never were built in the 60s for the TSA. You were never built for security. And you've got to be able to build that into an existing footprint.
Absolutely.
That's a big challenge.
It is, because you never know what you're going to find when you start tearing into some of these old buildings as well. But yeah. our development team has done a fantastic job with
it. Have you been able to improve? I mean, this is maybe a TSA issue, but from a design issue, have you been able to improve the passenger flow?
We actually have. I mean, we've implemented additional spaces in certain areas. Currently, we're just getting ready to upgrade Concourse G, put another Delta Sky Club down in that area, working hand-in-hand with Delta to do that. So there's a number of areas that we've improved to help that along.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Joining me now, a Minneapolis native, or Minnesota native, I should say. A Minnesota native, who's the restaurant reviewer for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Rick Nelson, how are you, sir?
I'm well. Thanks for coming to Minnesota.
Well, first of all, let's celebrate the fact that you have paper still.
Yes, we have a thriving newspaper here in Minneapolis.
I love it. And I'm going to give you my history of food in Minnesota.
All right.
Okay? Because I went to school in Wisconsin, so we're not too far apart.
Exactly.
When I was in school in Wisconsin, sauteed was actually deep fried. We had pizza, followed by pizza, followed by a fish fry or a fish boil, right?
That was it. Exactly.
Things have changed
a little
big
bit.
Big time.
Yeah, no.
Big time. I mean, even here at the airport. I mean, the food here at the airport's unbelievable now.
It's terrific here, and it's, I think, a role model for airports for around the country.
I mean, I going through the terminal today, and you're just looking around going, I had no idea. Even though I'm traveling all the time,
right.
You're not used to it. Because let me give you the old days at this airport. Mm-hmm. Guess the age of the mystery hot dog in the rotisserie.
I remember coming here as a kid because there was kind of a fancy restaurant that my family would come to so we could watch the planes take off. That was the only place where you could get something that wasn't, you know, out of a package.
Yeah.
And it was terrible. Yeah.
But the plane, looking at the plane, look, yeah. Anytime I can watch planes take off, I'm a happy guy, right? Whether I'm in them or watching them.
Right.
Right. But now let's talk about the food. Here, they've changed it radically.
Radically. And one of the great things they've done is that they've reached out into the restaurant community here in the Twin Cities, and they found vendors and restaurateurs and chefs and brought them here into the airport.
Brands that are recognized in Minnesota.
In Minnesota. And some of them are doing kind of iconic Minnesota foods. And then some of them are just doing really delicious foods that just happen to be in Minnesota.
Right. And those foods would be?
Well, a really good example is a place called the Blue Door Pub, which specializes in the Juicy Lucy, which is a made in Minnesota hamburger.
I've been warned about the Juicy Lucy. You have to lean forward to eat it.
You do have to lean forward. So what it is,
it's a
very thick beef patty that's been filled with cheese of some kind.
Oh.
And when you take the first bite in it, usually the cheese kind of bursts and usually drains out.
Of course.
And so you've got to have it kind of strategically placed.
Okay, you know what this is? It's a BYOB. Bring your own bib.
Exactly.
No, but you know, I'm not a meat eater anymore. I stopped eating meat about 11 years ago, but you're making me angry because that would be what if I went back to meat, I would have two of those.
I have to tell you, they're delicious. It's like, why didn't someone think of this before? You know,
it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it really does.
It's sort of like a grilled cheese sandwich, except that there's no, it's covered by meat.
Covered by beef, exactly. Yeah. And they do all kinds of variations on them, and they do them really well. They use really great beef. They have beautiful, you know, they make beautiful buns. The cheese is first rate. It's a really terrific place to go.
Okay, but that's really in the fast food area
right.
When you think about it. But we're now talking a few notches up.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of other options you can do. I think, like, you know, one of the great lobster rolls in the Twin Cities, and you think lobster in the Twin Cities, but it's because of this airport. You know, we're a hub, and
you can fly anything in.
You can fly anything in here and get a lobster from the East Coast in 8 hours, and then you have it on your table. And so there's a place called the Smack Shack in the North Loop in Minneapolis that goes through, you know, 1,000 pounds of lobster a week. And they have an outpost here at the airport, and if you have a hankering for a really amazing lobster roll, you should go there.
Well, here's the thing. The locals in Minnesota would know about that.
Right.
But the people flying through here just need to know about it.
They need to know that, yeah. And luckily, some of these places are in really easy-to-find locations in the airport. There's a main concourse that's kind of a half shopping mall, half food concourse, and a lot of these places around that concourse.
You know, it's interesting when you try to think intuitively about airport design. When airports were first designed, retail wasn't part of the deal because you didn't spend a lot of time at the
right.
airport. Thanks to our air traffic control system, and thanks to airports that got jammed, really. I mean, look at LaGuardia, you know. All of a sudden, a lot of people were sitting around doing nothing.
Right.
Right? And opportunity then happens. Not by design, but because of circumstance. I mean, I look at the Charlotte airport. I used to laugh a lot because they have rocking chairs there. And everybody says, oh, isn't that cute? I said, no, that means you're going to be here a while.
Exactly.
So as long as you're going to be there a while, you might as well eat something that's not the, the mystery hot dog.
Right. It's a little unnerving to walk past a spa in an airport. Like, really? I'm going to be here long enough to have a spa treatment? But, you know, you're going to sometime.
Oh, listen. I'm going to be going to Qatar, and mm-hmm. their airport, HIA, they don't just have a spa. They've got swimming pools. They've got... No, they've got unbelievable massage places. They've got bowling alleys. I mean, it's like, let's go to the airport.
Right.
It becomes a destination.
I love that.
Yeah. See, your parents brought you out here when you were a kid
right.
to watch planes.
For the same thing, right?
Now you can do the same thing, but you get to eat a lobster roll.
Yeah. And do, you know, do a couple of laps. I love that. Yeah, in Qatar.
In Qatar. I don't think they have the pool here.
Not yet.
I'm waiting for Minnesota to get the hockey rink at the airport. That's what I'm waiting for.
Although you
or the curling area.
Right. You can take a light rail connection to the Mall of America, which is, you know, two stops
I'm shocked.
To the west. I know. And they're building a $250 million water park. So maybe that little swimming pool dream of yours will come true.
Rick Nelson, stick with me. We got more coming up with Rick. All right. We know that the airports, if they're smart, have figured it out. And they become destinations in a way,
mm-hmm.
Whether you like it or not, right?
Right.
They are. But let's talk about the city as well.
You know, I think a lot of people have this misnomer about Minneapolis and St. Paul is this cold. And it is cold here in the winter. And there's nothing to do. No. We have a thriving culinary scene here along with a thriving arts scene and, you know, a cultural scene. Frankly, there's not a lot to do in the winter. So we get out and we really enjoy our
entire
year.
Let me guess. Would that be drinking and eating?
Drinking and eating.
Yeah.
It's a high priority. And baking. This is a great bakery city.
Oh, listen. That part I know.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I love that. But here's the other thing. I discovered this because my newspaper column used to run in the St. Paul paper.
Right.
The Basque food. I mean, all the French food mm-hmm. in St. Paul.
There's a, you know, there's a beautiful tradition of all kinds of, you know, we're a city of immigrants, frankly.
Yeah.
And so those kinds of populations grew up and made really amazing restaurants. One of my favorite stories is the number of Vietnamese and Hmong and Southeast Asians who moved here starting in the 1970s.
Now, as Vietnam was falling apart.
Right. And they came here. And of course, a lot of them opened restaurants because that's kind of a gateway way for people to work. Now, the children of those people are making some of the best restaurants in the Twin Cities. And I find that a really exciting. I'll give you two. One in St. Paul is called Nong Bistro. It's one of my favorite places to dine in the Twin Cities. It's Vietnamese and French crossed with farm to table. So.
And by the way, Vietnamese French, that's where the French were, folks.
Right.
So that's, yeah.
Exactly. And he's a really gifted chef. His name is Hai Trong. And I love going there for something as simple as a rice bowl with grilled chicken or the best pho in the Twin Cities or a beautiful pork rillette. It's an amazing restaurant. My other suggestion is a really exciting place in Northeast Minneapolis called Hai Hai, which means 22 in Vietnamese, because it's at 22nd and University. It's in a former strip club called the 22.
So it's got it's character.
It's got character.
And it's a young, they still have the pole?
Right. And no, unfortunately,
oh.
It doesn't. But the floor still has the dents from where the high heels, you know, dug into the floor. So it's a nice little look for it, right? And it's this really great.
Wait a minute. You went in there looking for that, didn't
of course
you?
I did.
Did. Okay.
I think I put it on Instagram. But it's got this really great vibe to it, and it's mostly about Southeast Asian street food. It's a young couple. They love to travel, and they love to replicate the foods that they have across Vietnam and Thailand, and the bar is really great. They've got a sugarcane press, and they make these amazing sugarcane juice drinks. You have to go there if you're in the Twin Cities.
Wow.
Yeah.
And by the way, street food in Asia, I live for that.
Yeah.
That's what I do.
Right.
And the rule of thumb, by the way, if you're going to Asia, as long as it's cooked, you can eat it.
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Out in the street.
Right?
It's the best.
Yeah.
It's the best. All right. So while we're on this subject,
mm-hmm.
okay, let's just say I've never been to Minneapolis or St. Paul, right?
Right.
And I'm saying, hey, Rick, where are we going for breakfast? Where are we going?
Well, we're going to a place called Al's Breakfast, which has been around for almost 60 years. It's by the University of Minnesota. It's a little 13-seat diner. I remember
Wait, this is in Dinkytown?
In Dinkytown.
I love that.
Which is like the Westwood of to UCLA, Dinkytown.
When somebody hears the word Dinkytown. Yeah, go ahead.
And I remember the late Wendell Anderson, who was a governor of Minnesota in the 1970s, he once told me that he took all the big shots to Al's, which was like one of my favorite memories ever. And you go there, and it's a little tiny diner, and there's this whole culture about how you get a seat, how you wait in line.
You wait for your seat.
Oh, you wait for your seat.
Yeah,
and it's, you know,
it's got the old counter?
Oh, yeah. It's a 10-foot wide building, and people are jammed into it, and it has really phenomenal pancakes, amazing hash browns, you know, beautiful Eggs Benedict. It's a, and it's a wild.
And is it only open for breakfast?
Only open for breakfast, and it's a very un-Minnesota culture because you're really jammed in. You have to talk to your neighbors. And Minnesota,
God forbid, you have to have a conversation.
And in Minnesota, that's really asking for something. We're a very standoffish people here.
Do you know what that comes from? The Scandinavian roots.
Of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
Let's be aloof.
Right.
I know.
Don't tell anybody too much about yourself.
Yeah.
Right.
But here's the good news, and this also applies to Wisconsin, where I went to school. Not everybody talks, but you don't have to lock your door.
True, right.
That's the trade-off.
Yeah, it's a great place to raise a family, as they say.
Yeah, it's a great place to raise a family, it is. All right, now, we did breakfast.
Yeah.
Lunch.
So for lunch, I would take you to the American Swedish Institute in Minneapolis to their restaurant called Fika, which is this really extraordinary.
We just talked about Scandinavia. Now
yeah,
we go to
right.
the American Swedish.
You know, it's this extraordinary
Let me
place.
Guess. Meatballs.
Well, of course, Swedish meatballs, but they also have, you know, beautiful gravlax. They've got wonderful open-faced sandwiches.
Anytime you have gravlax with the honey mustard or the dill, I'm there.
You're there, right?
Yeah.
And it's perfect. And they make beautiful breads, these really hearty Danish rye breads. It's this very contemporary setting, and it's next door to what people in the city call the castle, which was built by this Swedish publisher. And you can tour the institution afterwards. And this is great celebration of Scandinavian culture here in Minneapolis.
All right, so we got that one under control. And now dinner.
Okay, so dinner. If you can't get into Demi, which is where I had dinner last night, which is Gavin Kaysen's new 20-seat restaurant, and it's a tasting course-only opportunity.
So basically, you sit there and you can't order from the menu. You're getting what you're getting.
You're getting what you're getting. And it's an exceptional experience. And it sounds really, when you say tasting menu, it sounds really stuffy.
Okay,
and like, you know,
I have to ask
a
stupid question.
Yeah.
It's a 20-seat restaurant?
Yes.
How does he make money?
Well, it's not inexpensive. That's how he makes money. I think I paid about $180 a person last night for dinner.
If you are continuing on to another Southwest destination, please make sure that you check the monitors inside the terminal for your proper gate and flight information. If you are continuing on with another airline, we really don't care.
I am a passenger.
Audible.com has more than 150,000 titles and virtually every genre. So check it out for yourself. Sign up today at www.audiblepodcast.com/travel today to get a free audiobook and 30-day trial. We're talking about more and more people traveling, not just to it, but through it every year. Minnesota is one of my favorite states. Most of my friends consider it a flyover state, mistakenly. I went to school in Wisconsin, so I'm a Badger, which means, of course, we love beating the Gophers, but we won't talk about that here. I want to encourage all of you. People always say to me, where should we go this summer? I go, I'm going to tell you, Iowa, Indiana, Minnesota, Wisconsin. Go to the places you fly over. And also go to Chicago. You ask people if they've been to Chicago, and they say, yeah, and then you find out they just changed planes once at O'Hare. Doesn't qualify. So a person who's joining me now knows all about spending time in Minnesota. She's the editor-in-chief at Minneapolis St. Paul Magazine, otherwise known as Jane Hagen Olson. How
Hello.
Are you?
Hello. Good.
And, I mean, do you love this state as much as I do?
I really do. I'm born and raised, educated, raising my family here, and sometimes I think, am I ever going to live anywhere else? I'd like to think I might, but so far...
Well, you know, they have an airport here. You could fly out.
I do. Mm-hmm. I do that.
Yeah.
I do that.
What's changed? I mean, when I first came here, I was a student at Wisconsin. I was also reporting for Newsweek. My column ran in the St. Paul Pioneer Press Dispatch every Saturday, every Sunday. But when I first came here, it was a different feeling.
Absolutely.
I mean, you didn't have a skyline.
Right.
You didn't have state-of-the-art food scene. You didn't have nightlife. I mean, zero. I mean, you had some theater, but you didn't have enough. In fact, you didn't have enough material to support a magazine.
Well, we did, but not as dynamic as it is now.
But now, my God. I mean, radical, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Having an international airport, I know we're at the airport, does make a difference. But also, we have 17 or 18 Fortune 500 companies here, so we have
Well, it makes a difference to them because they can get their people in
absolutely.
And out.
Absolutely. But there's a lot of money here. It's not depth of money you might see in some other more affluent cities, but there are people who are out and about and taking in dining and going to the theater and art scene, and you need that. You need everybody getting out and about and embracing the city to keep the city vibrant.
Well, your art scene and your theater scene is huge. Your museum here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean...
Between the Walker Art Center, which is the contemporary, and then the Minneapolis Institute of Art,
right.
which
but,
is...
Well, the Walker, I mean, you can't miss it. I mean, that sculpture in the front, I mean,
yeah, exactly.
Amazing, right?
Right on the edge of downtown, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, the Institute as well.
Yes.
But the theater scene here, right?
Yep.
It used to be, if the Rolling Stones were on tour, they didn't necessarily stop here.
Nope.
You get every big act now.
We do. And not only do we get every big act, we get also Neil Young came through this winter, and it was when we were in the polar vortex, and he had four consecutive nights at four different venues, and he likes historic theaters. And so he performed in four different historic theaters to small, very intimate crowd, and this is the only place he did that.
You know what? At the end of the day, if you're looking for real, you come to Minnesota.
Yep.
Seriously.
No, I agree. Well, I'm from here, and I think it's pretty
real.
No,
but I'm telling you this as a born and raised New Yorker.
Yeah, I love it.
If you want a reality check, go to Madison, Wisconsin.
Yep.
Go to Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find it.
Yep.
And you're going to find something else which, it sounds almost elitist to say, but you're going to find something else that you don't necessarily find everywhere else. You're going to find community.
Mm-hmm. Definitely community. We're a very literate city, too. We've got a lot of small book publishers, and people are involved with bookstores and getting to libraries. Independent bookstores, most important.
Yeah.
I think our Wild Rumpus, which is this darling little children's bookstore in South Minneapolis, there's a kid-sized door. There's real animals that live there. They were just named best independent bookstore in the country 2 years ago.
I love it.
So it's just those little fun little nuggets.
And let's face it, because of weather, you've had to become creative.
Yeah.
Right?
There's a old wives' tale that the reason we have so many patents in Minnesota isn't just because of 3M and Medtronic. It's because all winter long, what did all these people do? They'd tinker in the garage, and you'd tinker in the basement, and out of that came a lot of intellectual property and patents. We have a lot of patents here.
I mean, when you think about it, you know, the colder the thermometer, the more opportunity you have to think,
mm-hmm.
the more opportunity you have to converse,
yep.
And to collaborate.
Yep.
You're just going to do it indoors.
The other thing I've seen change really in the last few years, the last 10 years, is how we have major biking community here. We've got a lot of innovation going on with our cities for bike lanes, but it doesn't stop in the winter. And we have even more cross-country skiing and more ice hockey than ever. I mean, the U.S. pond hockey tournament that's here that takes over Lake Nokomis. Anybody who's flying into the airport goes over Lake Nokomis, and I don't know how many ice rinks they have, like 20 of them with this pond hockey tournament. So we've really embraced our winter in a way that I haven't seen earlier in my life.
I have to tell you, as much as I think I know about the Midwest, I've never heard pond hockey.
Yeah, pond hockey. Hockey players want to play on real ice. They don't want to always play in an arena. So getting on the ice and playing on how it used to be done is huge. And so the pond hockey tournament is here.
Have you done stories about that in your magazine?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you have a pond hockey issue?
No, but when we had the Super Bowl here last year,
yeah.
We have the Winter Carnival in St. Paul. We have the pond hockey tournament. There's a new Minneapolis initiative tied in with our Loppet, which is our cross-country ski. They tied it all in together now, and it's one big winter festival in both cities, and it led up to the Super Bowl. So we last year, we kind of got our act together of making everything really cohesive.
You know what's interesting about it's like the Olympics. The Olympics and the Super Bowl allow cities to kick themselves in the butt and get ready for one event that only lasts, in one case, 1 weekend, or in the Olympics, maybe 2 weeks.
I talked to somebody who lives in Atlanta, and they said after going to our Super Bowl and then their Super Bowl this year, that when the Super Bowl is in a warm climate, it's just another warm city. And when people came here and actually went to the north for a Super Bowl, it was an experience. I mean, they were in a different place. And I do think that the Game of Thrones and all the north and Winterfell and Jon Snow, we've been writing the jokes around Minneapolis and St. Paul about that. We're the kings of the north.
But at least you have a dome stadium.
Yes, we do.
That helped.
Yeah, absolutely.
They did the Super Bowl at MetLife Stadium in New York, and they were taking a risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that could have been one.
That's true.
That could have been Green Bay.
Yeah. Yes, it could have.
It could have easily been Green Bay.
We have a beautiful stadium.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
What's the biggest surprise? We're almost out of time, but what's the biggest surprise when people come here for the first time that they're not expecting?
When they come in the warm months, they can't believe how green it is. People come, they go, it's so green. It's so dynamic. And all of our lakes and our rivers is something that people, 150 years ago, they didn't build around the lakes. And so it's accessible to everybody.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel, cruising and playing the radio, with no particular place to go.
As many of you listen to the show know, I'm a firefighter in New York. I've been a volunteer since I'm 18, and I greatly believe that wherever you go in the world, one of the first places you should ever stop is the firehouse, simply because not only are they great guys and women, but they are great resources of information about their community. They've been in everybody's house. They've been in everybody's hotel. They've been in everybody's restaurant. They know where to go, and they even know where not to go. And so, of course, the minute I landed at the airport here, where did I go? I went right to the firehouse, and I grabbed somebody there. She's a firefighter. She's also a fire rescue, of course. Natalie Forrest, how are you?
I'm great.
I mean, great tour of the airport. Thank you for that. Great tour of your facilities. And I have to say, as a firefighter, they've got the most immaculate garage I've ever seen. I mean, unbelievable. It's like a new car showroom. I'm telling you. But what most people don't realize about airport firefighters, and Natalie and I were talking about this off mic, is in a given day, you guys get banged out a lot. It's not like the airport movies where there's one plane that's going to have an emergency landing every 7 years. I mean, a light goes off in the cockpit, you know, like a warning light. That triggers a response from you.
Absolutely. In any given day, like you said, we can have, let's say, up to 25 calls a day. We can have as few as, you know, a handful, five or six. But with that being said, we could be at a medical on a having a patient, let's just say a cardiac, having a heart attack.
A passenger
or an airport employee. And at the same time or shortly after, we could be toned out for an aircraft emergency, which is obviously our primary reason that we're here. But it can be, like you said, a light in a cockpit. But sometimes they're very serious. I mean, flap issues, hydraulics, landing gear, smoke in the cabin.
Right.
So and then you could get toned out for a car accident right after that or a structure fire. So we're always on our toes.
You are. This morning you had a medical, I noticed. By the way, response time, of course, is always key.
Absolutely.
Right? And you guys pride yourself on that.
Absolutely. It's nothing to joke about, but as you know, firefighters, you have to find humor in what you do or you'd go crazy. We have one of the fastest response times for cardiac emergencies and medicals in general. Because if you think about it, if you're at home and a city department is responding, they have to get from their station all the way through town, navigate to find your house, where when we get dispatched, we can get to you because we're able to cross runways and taxiways with our fire trucks, our emergency vehicles. We can get there in under a minute sometimes.
That's critical.
Huge. We have the highest save rate in for people going into cardiac arrest in the country.
So basically, if you're going to have a heart attack, MSP is the place to be.
That's what they say. I know it's not a good statistic.
No,
but
I'll tell you something. I'll give you the statistic in Las Vegas. The biggest problem in Las Vegas was response time. Because of the traffic on the strip, they couldn't get to the casinos in time. So what the firefighters did in Las Vegas is they trained all the security guards at the casinos on CPR and how to operate the defibs.
That's smart.
And you know what? They have the best recovery rate in the United States as a resort destination because they're responding in less than 90 seconds.
I believe it.
Which is amazing.
It's huge. And if you look when you go around the terminal.
You have it.
We're so lucky. We have AEDs all over in the terminal. Plus we have obviously the equipment that we bring up with us, but if something is going to happen, we can get to you so quickly, and we have some of the best state-of-the-art medical equipment that's out there, so we're really lucky.
So if you have response time plus equipment plus expertise, it's pretty good.
Absolutely. And you think about traveling, like you said earlier, it's a stressful environment.
Well, you know, so people don't often take their meds.
Yep.
They're late, they're confused.
They don't sleep, they don't eat.
Right.
It's almost
they're dehydrated.
That's huge. And you know, it blows me away how many people don't take care of themselves when they're getting ready for a trip, especially people who don't travel a lot. They might have packed their meds in their check bag, or they have a few cocktails and then take some medications, and, you know, it's...
You know, that brings up an interesting point that doesn't just apply to this airport. It applies to all airports. Short of putting breathalyzers at jetways, right?
Yep.
I see people come out to the airport, and they just drink and drink and drink. And the worst thing I can imagine is somebody inebriated at 35,000 feet, and they were already drunk when they got on the plane.
Oh, we deal with a lot of that, way more than I ever realized. But yes, a lot of our calls are alcohol-related, unfortunately.
Yeah, and you're not alone. It's an airport-wide problem. I mean, just not just Minnesota.
Yep, because, I mean, in addition to drinking too much, it causes them to fall. We have huge escalators. We have a lot of steps, as in any airport, moving walkways. So mix that with a few too many drinks.
So I'm assuming, I mean, in my department in New York, at least one-third of our calls are medical. I'm assuming that's the case here, too.
That is the case.
Right. And the other third of our calls are automatic alarms that prove out to be not a problem.
Sure.
Right? I mean, just somebody left a pilot light on, and then the other third are actually real fires. About the same here?
Yeah, that's about the same.
Yeah.
We, you know, as we kind of chatted earlier, we have a unique setting out here is most of our buildings are commercial buildings where they have sprinklers in them.
And that's the key. If you're listening to this program and you're thinking about staying at a hotel, when you check in, ask them if they have sprinklers. Because when you see these terrible fires, we report on this every single year on the news, the Grenville Towers fire in London or other big fires, even the fire that just happened, you know, last month in Notre Dame. I mean, I guarantee you that cathedral was not sprinkled. And even when they did all the renovations, they didn't retrofit it, right?
Yeah.
If you don't have a sprinkler system, and I'm speaking to you firefighter to firefighter, there's hardly a fire department in the world that can effectively fight a fire above the sixth floor, especially if there are no sprinklers.
Correct.
I mean, it's not a good idea.
Right.
And some of the fire codes that drive me nuts, even though they're well-intentioned, I was up in Lake Tahoe. We did the show up in Lake Tahoe. And I was with the fire chief, and beautiful resorts. It's so gorgeous, right? But the way the fire codes are written, if I build a new hotel tomorrow, I've got to perform to those new codes, right?
Yep.
But if my family has owned the hotel for the last 80 years, and it was handed down from my grandfather to my father and my father to me, I don't have to retrofit.
Yeah, it's
that's
scary.
Wrong.
And
yeah.
I don't think people, like you said, I don't think they realize it. You
so
would assume they would keep
as
up.
As travelers, you have a responsibility to yourself, not to mention everybody else, to at least ask them when you're making the reservation, are you up to code? Why wouldn't you want to ask that question?
Absolutely. I think of it all the time when I travel.
Yeah.
I don't think I did prior to being a firefighter.
So you're telling me MSP is up to code?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm just double checking. What's the craziest calls you get?
Oh, man. Well, like I said, one of the greatest things about being an airport firefighter is that you don't just train to be a truckie or on an engine company. You get trained on how to operate a crash truck, which is what we respond to aircraft emergencies. You need to be able to successfully operate that truck. You need to know how to pull a hand line off of an engine, operate an engine. You also need to be able to operate the rescue vehicles. We have the Mississippi and Minnesota rivers, plus lakes. So we have an airboat that we do water and ice rescue for. So, I mean, I could go on for days with crazy calls, but we see it all. And that's why I love this department.
Basically, never a dull moment.
Never. With 10 or over 100,000 passengers through here a day, it's a huge never. It's like the city that never sleeps, but in an airport version, is there's always people here. And so the crazy never stops.
Hello and welcome to Alaska Flight 438. We'd like to tell you now about some important safety features of this aircraft. The most important safety feature we have aboard this plane is the flight attendants. Please look at one now.
I learned something a long time ago when I was going to school in the University of Wisconsin, and that is we think of American Native Indians as the Southwest. We think of them as, you know, the Wild Wild West and cowboys and Indians. There are, I think, I may be wrong, but I think there are 11 independent Indian nations in the state of Wisconsin alone. And guess what? They're also in Minnesota. And joining me now is Jill Alberg-Yo, who's the associate curator of Native American art at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. I mean, honestly, we've been propagandized. People don't think of Indians when they think of the Midwest, especially in Minnesota.
Yeah, absolutely. And they also think of Indians as in the past, not contemporary people, as lawyers, as doctors, as people like you doing reporting.
Of course.
Yes.
And the thing is, they are thriving. They're working. They're an economic force. And we're not just talking about casinos.
That's correct. Yes. They have as many jobs as any other people would across the United States.
And yet, of course, when you talk about any kind of art, it's all about storytelling.
Yes. Yes.
And that's how they tell the stories.
Yes, especially so. Native American art is rich with so many deep stories.
Such as?
Oh, stories of survival, stories of resilience, stories of legacy, stories of power, stories of diplomacy, stories of influence, stories of struggle and independence.
And what nations are we talking about here in Minnesota?
There are Dakota nations.
Lakota too?
There are Lakota people here,
yeah.
But this is the homeland for the Dakota people, as well as Anishinaabe, otherwise known as the Ojibwe, as well as Ho-Chunk people.
Well, Ho-Chunk is also Wisconsin, too.
Yes, primarily.
Yes.
Yes.
I spent so much time there when I did my story there about the Indian nations. And I went to school there and I didn't know.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. Same. My children aren't being taught it right now, today.
Amazing.
Yes.
And they're keeping the traditions alive.
Absolutely. And they're creating new traditions every day.
The biggest challenge I think we have, at least in our country, is, and I'm certain other countries as well, is the loss of either historical knowledge or institutional knowledge or cultural knowledge, and how things are not necessarily always being handed down. That applies to language. It applies to ritual. It also applies to art.
Yes, I would say that, but I always love to give a counter narrative that things are always being created. There's a very common saying in Native American studies that, and especially Native American art, that everything has been contemporary. So something made in the 1700s was contemporary. Something made in 2019 is contemporary.
You know what that means? Well, we're contemporary.
We're contemporaries.
How long has the Institute had Native American art?
We've had Native American art since the early 20th century, but we really bolstered our collection in the 1990s.
I'm going to suggest something, tell me if I'm wrong, that when you had it since the early 20th century, that was almost accidental.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Yes. Just a few handful of pieces that people would bring from the Southwest, as you talked about, and bring them into the collection. But we went full force in the 1990s.
Now it's intentional.
Yes, absolutely.
When you come to the Institute, what would be the biggest surprise for me in terms of that collection that I'm really not expecting to see?
What we love to do is give the unexpected. Something like Jeffrey Gibson's punching bag that's fully beaded, fully full silk ribbon.
How big is it?
It is as big as a punching bag. Something like a wood sculpture made by George Morrison in the 1990s, somebody who was taught by the New York School with people like Franz Kline. So just opening up people's ideas that Native American art isn't static, isn't of the present, is a part of our story.
Well, it's almost stereotypical to think that Native American art was either crude or just basic. It's actually quite intricate.
Right. I've heard artists say that some of the most beautiful Native American art is that has the hardest finish. So it may take, say, of your 100% of time, 90% of that time is in the finishing technique. And that's what makes something very beautiful.
And enduring.
Yes.
Amazing. How many days do you open a week?
We are open 6 days a week. And we are open late on Thursdays and Fridays until 9.
Cool.
Yes.
Anybody can come.
Yes.
Admission?
Yes. It's free.
Even better.
Yes, it's free. And some of our special exhibitions, like the one that's going to happen, Hearts of Our People, Native American Women Artists, do have a fee.
Where are the wagons?
The wagon is too slow. Can't you ride?
It's not that he can't ride. How is it you put it home?
They're dangerous at both ends and crafty in the middle. Why would I want anything with a mind of its own bobbing about between my legs?
Every time I come to the Midwest, which is, by the way, as often as I can come, and with due respect to full disclosure, I went to school in Madison, Wisconsin, so I consider myself an unofficial Midwesterner, I'm always amazed at the opportunities that you can do and you can have with history that people don't necessarily understand the history here. Most people don't even come here. They fly over Minnesota. And if they tell you that they've been here, they've probably changed planes at the airport. That doesn't count. My next guest knows a little bit about that because she's from the Minnesota History Center at the Minnesota Historical Society. Annie Johnson, how are you?
Hello, nice to be here.
And nice to have you here. You know, when I was growing up, going to a museum was a big deal, but then again, it was intimidating because I couldn't touch anything. I couldn't hang out with anything. I could look through a glass window. And it got to the point where I got so prejudiced by that in the wrong way that I didn't want to go to museums anymore because I didn't feel I could do anything, right? That has changed, hasn't it?
It definitely has changed. I think many museums, including ours, the Minnesota History Center, really look for ways to engage people in history, and not only in the great collections that we have and the things that you get to see, but also recognizing that people do learn so much better through hands-on exploration.
Well, it's really
and conversation.
About, yeah, conversation and connecting the dots. You know, you ask kids where food comes from, they tell you the story. I got a problem with that, right? And if you can tell the story and tell the history so that people understand the process, then they can understand where they are in their world today.
Definitely.
So tell me what you're doing at the museum that speaks to that.
Sure. I think that we really try at the Minnesota History Center to tell the story of Minnesota, like you said, in a way that's engaging and interactive. We have so many approaches in telling not only Minnesota history, so everything from the Dakota and Ojibwa, Minnesota's indigenous communities, their history in the past
and today. And we talked about this earlier in the show, and that is people don't realize that the Indian population, the American Native population in states like Minnesota and Wisconsin was substantial. I mean, people think it's just cowboys and Indians in the Southwest. You have, I mean, Wisconsin has like 11 sovereign Indian states. People don't know this.
Oh, we have, you know, a vibrant culture with those communities here. And in fact, historic Fort Snelling located at Bedote, that's just across from the airport here, is not only a site that the History Center runs that tells military history.
Well, you have an amazing national cemetery there.
Yes, the National Cemetery. It's also located at Bedote, which is a sacred site to the Dakota people, one of their sites of creation. So we try to tell the history that is known and more visible, and the history that most people don't know, and complicate things a little bit. And
all right, Annie, tell me something I don't know.
Tell you something you don't know. Oh,
about
goodness,
your history.
About our history. Wow. So I think an example might be the historic Fort Snelling, as another example, the Dred Scott decision that was one of the factors leading to the Civil War. Dred and Harriet Scott were a married couple who met at Fort Snelling, and they were enslaved by the surgeon there who was stationed there. And they ended up they lived in several places throughout the country, and they ended up going to the Supreme Court the case went to the Supreme Court to sue for their freedom, which was ultimately denied by the Supreme Court because they had lived in free places. So Minnesota has connections with the Civil War and the history of slavery that many people don't know.
And from the You're Not in Kansas Anymore department, you have a tornado exhibit.
We do at the History Center. I think Minnesota is known for their weather, but oftentimes people just think it's blizzards all the time. we definitely do have four seasons, five if the joke goes.
Well, if you look at the map of the United States, you are part of Tornado Alley.
We definitely are. And one of the key signature experiences at the museum, we have a tornado basement that tells the story of the 1965 Fridley tornadoes here in the Twin Cities that were quite devastating. But it's an interactive experience where kids and families and visitors get to go in and sit down and kind of be in this recreation of what that's like and tell a really emotional story.
Because let's face it, you want to feel alone real fast? Try being in the basement when the tornado's coming.
Yeah.
Right?
Definitely.
Have you ever done that?
Oh, I think anyone. I grew up here in Minnesota. I think we all know what it's like to hear those sirens go off and have to take cover.
Exactly. Now, you also have just a few petroglyphs.
Yes, Jeffers Petroglyphs down in southwestern Minnesota are 7,000-year-old rock carvings. So again, another really important site for our indigenous communities and a really lovely history. And Minnesota has so many different landscapes, and that's a chance to really get out on the prairie and see something pretty special.
You're originally from North Dakota.
Well, I was born in North Dakota, but I always lived in Minnesota.
From North Dakota.
Yes,
sorry, you are.
It's on my passport. Lovely state.
There you go. But when people come to visit now, what's the first thing, that the biggest surprise to them when they get here that they're not expecting to see?
Sure. I think here in the Twin Cities, the parks and the lakes, I think, are really important. The amount of outdoor activities, especially if you're visiting here in nice weather, but in the winter as well, we have things like the St. Paul Winter Carnival that is really a chance for Minnesotans to celebrate winter in all of its forms.
I love how you say we celebrate winter.
We have to.
That's like celebrating weather. But you've turned it into a celebration.
Yes.
When in doubt, have a party.
Definitely.
Exactly. But what about the food?
Oh, the food is fantastic. And another exhibit that we've had at the museum recently is a partnership with the Somali Museum in Minnesota. And Minnesota, again, is not often known for being a very diverse place, but we do have quite a lot of diversity here. And we've worked with the Somali Museum, and they've brought in a lot of food for our programs, including sambusa, which are fantastic, kind of the Somali version of samosas, which are so delicious and spicy. So we do eat spicy food up here, too.
So bring some water.
Yes.
You always have to do a little bit of that. What's the biggest surprise exhibit you have at the center?
Well, we're so excited. We have an exhibit on First Avenue, Minnesota's main room, that is just open now. So the iconic rock club, First Avenue, made famous to a lot of people as the place kind of where Prince, it was his signature place to perform, and he filmed Purple Rain there and recorded that song off the album.
And you have an exhibit with that.
We do. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary in 2020. So we worked with them to really tell the behind-the-scenes stories of that place.
And there's just a little bit of music in that room, perhaps?
There's a lot of music in our exhibit.
Yeah.
But for the real experience, you should go to First Avenue and see a show live there.
Absolutely. Annie Johnson from the Minnesota History Center at the Minnesota Historical Society. Thanks for coming.
The charge for looking at this pamphlet is $3. The charge for looking at this pamphlet and putting it back quickly is $4.
My next guest, columnist at the Star Tribune here in Minneapolis, but even better than that, the author of one of my favorite books, The Gallery of Regrettable Food. I love it. It reminds me of a book I did once called Don't Go There,
right,
where I listed all the places in the world you should never go. James Lilacs, welcome to the show.
It was a book about food that you ought not to eat from the 50s and 60s, and you won't find any of it here. If you really wanted to give people a taste of Minnesota culture in all of its glory, you would have a restaurant here that served Jell-O embedded with some sort of wiggling carrots or the like, because they'll still serve that to you out in a church basement somewhere in the hinterlands. But here, no, at the airport, they've declined to give you those authentic Minnesota regrettable recipes.
Yes, I know. Well, look, airport food was, by definition, regrettable for so many years.
Forever. I remember first when I started flying, you had one option at the airport, and it was always a hamburger that had been cooked about 3 years before, some fries that were soggy and as limp as could
be. Yes, they were.
And brackish boiled coffee that would take the paint off the table. It was horrible. And now, of course, you can come here and have an Epicurean festival.
So things are better.
I'd say, yeah.
Okay.
I'd say, yeah.
Now, the history of this airport is interesting as well.
It is. This started out, as far as I know, and I'm no historian in the matter, but I've done a little bit more than read Wikipedia. It used to be a raceway, a speedway, where people could come and ride those newfangled flivvers fast and flip over and crash and the like, and eventually that went bust. But since there was already roads out here and reasonably straight lines for the cars, they thought, why not an airport? And so planes started to come here, and eventually it was called Wold Chamberlain after a couple of World War II fighters. And so that's when the aviation industry started to kick in. And in those early days, if you go back and look at the newspapers, which I do for a living and a hobby, you will find there's a crash about every other day somewhere. And here at the airport, which has got a remarkable safety record, in the early days it was a little bit dodgy. I read a story about a fellow who was trying to set a duration record, which they did a lot in the 20s. How long can you stay up? So it'd be two guys. One guy would sleep in the back while the other flew. I mean, imagine in some loud, clattering tin can rolling around the sky up there with a loud engine and the pistons going, and they'd still sleep, but they had to come down to get sandwiches and oil. So the guy makes a low pass to grab the sandwiches and the oil and the bucket of oil on a stick, on a pail, pulls up a little too sharply, stalls, and it was one of those, well, guy was trying to set a record, didn't make it, two killed. And that was ordinary fare for the newspapers in the 20s.
Wow.
But not anymore.
No.
This is a completely different operation. Lindbergh, by the way, would show up. And there's a story about Lindbergh taking up one of the oldest men in the city, a city founder who gave us our Walker Art Center and many other things, one of the richest men in the country. And at the end of his life, a month before he died, Lindbergh took him up to look down at this city, which was virtually nothing when he arrived. And now was this bustling metropolis, which was so
well,
odd.
Well, every year I try, actually every other year I go to the Oshkosh Air Show, mm-hmm. which is so amazing. Yep. And about 2 years ago, they said to me, hey, we've arranged for you to have a ride in a Ford Trimotor, right?
Okay.
And I said, really? And they said, they brought it out of a museum and it still flies. And you want to do it? I said, yeah. So here's the wild thing. My mother, before she died, came to me one day and she says, I got something I want to give you. And she gave me, it looked like an old road map that would accordion out. Mm-hmm. It's hard back on the front part, but it was just like this. And what it was, and it said Transcontinental Air Transport on the cover. That was the predecessor to TWA.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a commemorative thing that they gave every passenger on the very first transcontinental flight that my grandfather was on.
Wow.
On the front of it, when it opened an accordion out, it was the map of the railroads, because when they flew, they followed the tracks.
Yep.
On the back, it had my grandfather's name certifying that he'd been on the first Transcontinental Airlines flight, and it was signed by the pilot, Charles Lindbergh.
That's fantastic.
Wait. It had the tail number of the plane on it.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Right.
Now I go to Oshkosh.
No.
Same
no.
plane. Now, my grandfather flew it in 1929,
mm-hmm.
and I flew it 2 years ago in 2017.
That's extraordinary.
That on the same plane.
So what were the passenger conditions like in the inside? Because you see the
old
pictures.
Wooden, it was yeah. beautiful wooden seats, mm-hmm. wainscoting, varnish, beautiful lamps with crystal.
Right.
It only held, I think, 14 passengers.
Right. If you look at the old pictures in the yeah. old movies, it's about seven people, three of whom are smoking.
Oh, they're all smoking.
They're
yeah.
all, yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. So we have a Lindbergh connection there. But How has things, we know that things have changed here at the airport.
Right.
Things have also changed in Minnesota.
Oh, well, a great deal. You can look back at, for example, the way the airport used to be in its early days, and we have a extensive record of it in 1970 that is available to anybody who turns on the television, because the movie Airport, the interiors, were shot here. So you get a wonderful...
George Kennedy.
Yes, yes. Joe Petroni, Burt Lancaster. When you walk through the front doors of this airport, you're walking through the doors Dean Martin himself went through. And when I tell people, Helen Hayes once was ferried around these corridors, they give you a blank look, and that is exactly who... But you can go back and see the architectural styles, the fashions, and the rest of it. At that time in 1970, this was still not the city it is now. It hadn't quite grown up and gotten the growth spurt that really kicked.
You're making me feel very old. The movie Airport shot 49 years ago.
I'm feeling a little bit crepuscular myself,
yeah.
When you put it that way.
Yeah.
But at least...
I went to school with my friends, the Zucker brothers, who did
Airplane, which of course is based on the movies that Airport
all those
kicked
genres,
off.
Yes.
But in 1970, if you look downtown, there was one tall building with a little point in the top, the Fauché Tower. And Now, if you look, there's this forest of skyscrapers that you can get to from here in the airport, you know, reasonably quickly by our modern high-speed rail system.
Which, by the way, most airports can't do because of the way the cities were designed. But you're able to do it.
Yeah, we had a corridor that they could run it up because this was a grain center and all the grain came here and then it was milled and turned into flour and that had to go out on railways as well. So we have these rail corridors that we can use, but it still takes a lot of political will to get it everywhere you want to go. But people who come to the airport here will want to go downtown or they'll want to go to the Mall of America, and for that, you know, the rail is just perfect.
And bottom line is, you can get there from here.
You can. And it depends what you want to do. If you want to shop, I wouldn't go downtown because we had the same retail difficulties that a lot of cities do. But but it's still a beautiful place, and it has something that few American urban centers do. It's got a skyway system that connects all the building on the second floor. So you can walk around inside and marvel at this sort of like Venice-like arrangement where the bridges of the skyways take you from one piazza to the other. As somebody who loves cities, I'd rather go walk around downtown Minneapolis and see our architecture than go to the mall and shop. But, of course, your family differences may vary. When we were 8 hours late for a flight, my wife and daughter said, we're going to the mall. And I'm the kind of guy who shows up at the airport 9 hours ahead of time in case
you
something...
You do?
Well, not nine, eight and a half, in case something happens. So the idea for me of leaving the airport to go to the mall and then come back... It was a little nerve-wracking. But
no,
wife,
when the going gets tough, what happens? The tough go shopping.
Then my wife is very, very tough. She's also the kind to run down the jetway just as they're closing the door in the assumption that she'll be able to hurl herself in and find a seat.
And wait, and does she?
No, because I unfortunately make everybody go to the airport at a reasonable time, assuming traffic accidents, tornadoes, marching bands going through TSA, all of the things that you think can get in the way of you getting on your plane.
All right, so you're the one guy there sitting in the lounge tapping your toes because you got nothing to do.
Oh, no, I'm not tapping my toes. I'm relaxed because I'm here. The great thing about this airport is that you don't have to walk around and try to find an outlet, which in some places, as you know, you'll have a guy camped out by an outlet with a knife between his teeth guarding this resource.
And usually sitting on the floor.
Yeah,
because that's
right.
Where I used to plug the vacuum machines at night.
Precisely.
Yeah, yeah.
Here, there are all kinds of USB and power outlets. So... whether or not they work, I don't know, but you feel good when you plug it in. So I love to get here. If I've got 3 hours to read and listen and cogitate and watch everything, that's fine. But people like me always marry people who get there at the last possible moment. This is an absolute truth in human relations. I don't know what it's, you know, those of us who want to get there early, see the excitement and the, you know, the vivacity of the person who wants to get there at the last minute, and they like the stability that we provide. So I guarantee you here at the airport, there's innumerable couples who had the argument before they got here. Why do we have to go so early?
Well, there's another argument too.
What's that?
I'll tell you the story. And it's different dynamics. And this is clockwork. You can tell time by this, okay? Mm-hmm. No matter what time we're leaving, no matter where we're going, my girlfriend will wait until they're closing the door to the jetway and go, oh, I got to go to the bathroom.
Ah! Yes, of course.
I mean, it's gotten to the point now where I'm going, okay, you can go now, because I know she's going to pull it, right? And it's just the way it is.
Perhaps... is she here with you on this trip?
No, she's not.
Okay, well, that's her loss, because I usually don't say this about a lot of public facilities, but we have some of the most beautiful bathrooms you're going to find in an airport.
Do you know, I'm not making this, well, you know, you won an award for it.
Mm-hmm.
You won an award for the cleanest airport bathrooms in the United States, I believe.
And that's no small thing, because we've all been to those airports where all of a sudden you learn to manipulate everything with your elbows. You know, you can undo your zipper with an elbow because the place is so, yeah. Here, in true Minnesota fashion, it is spotless and antiseptic and nice.
Yeah, and they've kept it up that way.
But beautiful. I mean, they have these murals and these mosaics that make you feel as though you're entering a work of art. How many times do you go to use a lavatory?
All right, so tell me the truth. You get to the airport early so you can appreciate the bathroom.
I visit them terminal by terminal, yes. I make a little peregrination through them to see what's been upgraded.
We've been talking with James Lilux from the Star Tribune, the author of The Gallery of Regrettable Food, and his love affair with the bathrooms here at the airport.
I wouldn't put it quite that way, but it's better than a love affair in the bathrooms at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport.
Hey, whatever works.
You know, the thing is, if you go to some places, some airports, they always seem to be perpetually under construction, right? And this is one of those.
But look, airports and hotels are by definition always under construction. You can't go to a hotel that's not in some form of renovation where they've closed off either a wing or a floor. In fact, my advice to people, I'll just say it right now, is before you ever get your hotel key, no matter what, where you've reserved a hotel room, when you're at that front desk, before they hand you the key, say, could you just do me a favor and tell me how close is my room to the construction?
Right.
And that'll help you, because otherwise you get the jackhammer suite.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the ambient asbestos wafting through the place as well. Yeah. Not here. I mean, they've recently done some work down in the concourse to rearrange the food area. Sometimes I come here and I think, have I not been to my airport in 2 years, or have they reconfigured everything in the course of a fortnight? But it's always better. There's always something more interesting and more better. A lot of airports, you go there, and year after year after year, they bear the same miserable, you know, 70s accoutrements and just the general state. You think, are they never, ever going to change this place? And then, of course, when you do go there, and it's all under construction, then you're angry at them for inconveniencing you and making you sit through this. So we're never satisfied when it comes to
it. Well, let's stay on that theme of never being satisfied. Is there one thing at this airport you still hate?
Oh, gosh, you're making me... Minnesotans,
because there's a lot of things to like about it, but...
Minnesotans don't say that we hate anything. We just simply say, well, that's different. And if there's anything that's... if there's anything that's
different,
it might be the scrum of having to pick somebody up or get picked up down there. I mean, that's never good at any airport, right? If you're being picked up by a car, that car has to fight its way through the herd of the others.
But I have a suggestion for you. This is how I do it.
That would be.
Okay. I haven't checked a bag in 9 years, okay?
Right.
There are only two kinds of airline bags, carry-on and lost. You with me? Okay. Now,
yes.
Let's move on. I completely disobey all airport signage.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to go to the airport in the morning for a flight,
mm-hmm.
I don't go to departures. I go to arrivals. There's no traffic there. Nobody's arriving at 7 in the morning.
Right.
There's no line. I haven't checked a bag. I don't have to check in. I printed up my boarding pass the night before. I just take the escalator up, go through security. I save a lot of time. When I arrive, there's no way I'm going to the refugee center known as arrivals.
Right.
That's screaming babies, dogs, police, and crazy people, right? Mm-hmm. I go to departures, and my friends pick me up there. There's nobody there.
It is possible. You can do that if, for example, you want to fight with the guards who are there, all of whom used to work for the Stasi in the East, East Germany when they dissolved the Soviet Empire. A lot of them took up work here. They will keep you from going up those stairs. Sir, you can't. But there's a way to do it. I mean, you go through a tunnel, around there, up an escalator, take an elevator, get on a parasail, go down to the main level. You can do what you've done. However, most people don't want to fight that. Most people just say, pick me up at gates or, you know, at whatever. And so you have all of these cars demonstrating, shall we say, not a devotion to the common humanity, but an individuality purpose that really kind of gets all backed up. So I'd fix that, but it's not something germane to this place. I might fix the distances, because sometimes it takes a while to get to another gate, but this place is not like, Denver, where you have to take Amtrak to get from one side of the place to the other.
Let me put it this way. People who design airports
mm-hmm.
should never be paid for their work until they've actually had to go through one. They weren't built for people. They were built for airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
There's a different way to do it. Look, you take a look at the Delta Terminal in New York at Kennedy.
Right.
That's called the New Terminal.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Bataan Death March to go from Gate 45 to baggage claim. You might as well bring a copy of War and Peace and read it. I mean, you're not going anywhere.
Oh, I know the feeling. You have to leave a trail of breadcrumbs in case somebody can find you, and have a pouch of pemmican on your side in case you need food
but
along the journey.
But the distances here aren't as great as New York. Manageable.
No, absolutely not. But when you mention New York, you mention LaGuardia. It's a shame that we don't have airports as beautiful as the terminal at LaGuardia. Not LaGuardia, but at...
please.
No, please. Yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Where was that?
What was I talking about? JFK. I mean, that great soaring TWA.
Which is now turning into a hotel.
Of course. What isn't? It's almost impossible to do that these days, because the sight lines to airports are surrounded by massive parking ramps, and you don't have that jewel sitting in the middle of the prairie like you used to do. But I wish there's a little bit more exterior beauty to give you a sense of Well, even Dulles, for example, concrete as it is, has a certain visual lift to it that you don't find.
It has a visual lift to it, but I hate the airport.
Oh, it's
I hate that airport. And those people movers, please. Even George Jetson would have killed them.
Those strange mobile lounges, you mean?
Mobile lounges.
You get in and you think, I had one of those in Paris where they put us on a bus and then they drove us to the other side of France and
right.
then we had to get off. And the only good thing about that was that you walked upstairs. And so my daughter, who was 14 or 15 at the time, had the experience of being in Paris and walking up the stairs to get on the plane, feeling like, you know, a celebrity who was waving to the paparazzi.
Exactly.
The beloved fans. And I liked that. So if they can incorporate a little bit more of that old-style glamour, I'd be happy.
Well,
without
listen, I go back to the days of North Central Airlines. You didn't have a jetway. You went up the stairs.
Right.
That was it.
Yeah, and we romanticized those days because we think that everybody was sitting there in a suit and tie and behaving themselves. And they probably were dressed that well. Maybe the food was a little...
No, it wasn't.
I've seen the recipes. No. But you have to remember that everything absolutely stunk of Winston's. That everything you got off
Oh, my God.
If you weren't a smoker when you got on the plane, you were a smoker when you got off.
Should there be a rapid change in cabin pressure, oxygen masks will automatically drop from the compartment above your seat, free of charge. And to start the flow of oxygen, pay your flight attendant $75.63.
My next guest runs something that most people don't know about. Because most people who will be coming to the airport here might not even know it exists. She's the executive director at the Airport Foundation of MSP. Jana Wester, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Why does an airport need a foundation, and what do you do?
You know, it's a funny question. I started this job 20 years ago, and I first saw back in the days when there was ads in the paper for job, and I saw this job, and I asked myself the same question. I said, why would an international airport need a foundation? And
Northwest?
Northwest.
North Central.
Yes.
Ozark.
Pre-9/11.
Yeah.
Yes, it was a different world then. But came to learn that it's a wonderful business model here, and I should say that we are the only airport foundation in the world, so it's a very unique business
That's
model.
That's why I had to ask the question. I've never heard of an airport foundation.
Yeah, it is. But we are able to provide programs and services that really enhance a travel experience for people here.
But you're not like greeters. I mean,
But
you are, but you're more than that, yes.
We are, yeah. So we have multiple programs that we run here at the airport, and we've got volunteers, and they do greet people, but that's part of what enhances the experience.
But it's more than that.
Oh, it's much more than that, and it's grown. I mean, it wasn't this big when I first got here, but the foundation has grown along with the airport.
Because I remember Traveler's Aid, there used to always be a Traveler's Aid desk somewhere, and it was always manned by my grandmother. I want you to know that. It was always manned by my grandmother. It was like, hello.
And it's right? still, yes, and that's what
it was
here.
And it was cute.
It's wonderful,
yeah.
You know, and so that was Traveler's Aid here many, many years ago and in a lot of airports around the country. What happened, and there still is a Traveler's Aid organization, I should say, but they focus more on trains and other sorts of transportation because airports are a big world. It's a big thing to handle. And so in the early 90s, Traveler's Aid backed out of this airport and the foundation stepped in and took over running the program and changed the name to Traveler's Assistance.
Right. And then, of course, you've expanded to include other things, including arts and culture.
Oh, yes. Yes. Well, and I should say that we don't just have human volunteers anymore. We now have dogs.
Oh, let me tell you about the dogs. I know about the dogs. I mean, I almost missed my flight because of one of your dogs.
Because you were loving it
I was
so much.
Loving it. Oh. I was petting it.
I know. Of the downside to this program.
I bet people have missed their flights because they were cuddling with their dogs.
I hope not. But if they do, then we have other volunteers that would run in and hold that flight.
Separate the passenger from the dog.
Yes. Yeah.
No, but, you know, people realize that, you know, an airport can be a stressful environment. Not can be, is. Whether you're a first-time flyer or, you know, or a road warrior like me, and bringing these dogs. And by the way, there are some airports, I used to know, which had miniature horses show up.
Yes.
Yes. I think Cincinnati. I may be wrong. But, I mean, there's a miniature horse at the airport. It does slow you down when you go,
But what's so bad about being slowed down at an airport?
I love that idea.
I know, and that's
unless
what we're trying to do.
Unless the airport intentionally slows you down for other reasons that have nothing to do with the airport.
Beyond your control.
Like my plane being canceled today. right?
But we do want to create these memorable experiences for people in the airport.
Yeah.
And so airports tend to be a little competitive with each other, and you want to be the airport of choice for people if they have a choice.
And the other thing, you know, you talk about arts and culture, an airport is a perfect opportunity to display art. It's a perfect opportunity to display new artists.
Yes.
Local artists, right?
Yeah, and so the goal of our arts and culture program, and many airports do have arts programs,
right.
I should say.
But can I tell you my idea with the arts program at most airports? 7-year-old kids drawing pictures of planes. That's the way it used to be. Come on.
It used to be.
And
yes.
Now it's different.
It is different.
Nothing against the 7-year-old kids. It's cute.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But art is part of public commissioned art now.
Yeah.
In most airports, and ours is no different, have a percentage.
Do you work with local museums in the area?
We do. Yeah. We do. And what we like to do is give back to the community through our arts program. So we provide spaces that regional arts groups can showcase their talents. And that creates those memorable experiences
for
our passengers.
Can I give you an idea for an art idea?
Well, maybe? No guarantee we're going to do it, but yes.
Okay, here it comes.
Yes.
It is almost by definition that at some point in your life at an airport, you're going to get delayed. It could be weather, could be mechanical, whatever. Have a program with right, so that you come up with paper and artist materials so that people draw their delay experiences at the airport and have a display about it. And they'll have such a great sense of humor about it. What I did during my delay.
And then do we have to display that art?
If you don't, I'm going to be very upset.
You've been listening to Peter Greenberg Worldwide. Catch us each week as we broadcast from a new location somewhere around the world.